WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Nobel laureate and party visiting professor Dr. Murray Gell-Mann in the second of two lectures on regularities and randomness in the past and the future.
The history of the universe is predicted only probabilistically by science, and that the actual history is co-determined by the fundamental laws of physics, which just give probabilities for different alternative histories.
Nobel laureate Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
The U.S. Administrator for Iraq, Paul Bremer, announcing the capture of Saddam Hussein by U.S. forces today. The applause came from Iraqi reporters. Some of them shouted, "Death to Saddam." The head of the Army's 4th Infantry Division said Saddam was caught like a rat in a hole. He was found hiding in a hole dug in the ground at a farm near his hometown. Saddam had a handgun but offered no resistance. Hundreds of troops had flooded the farm. The man they found was a far cry from the intimidating dictator of years past. He was disheveled and disoriented with unruly hair and a thick beard. Later, after he was cleaned up, Saddam resembled the Saddam of old, but as Bremer said, the tyrant is now a prisoner. Saddam was defiant, though, when Iraqi officials visited him in captivity. The news that Saddam was captured has had an impact on the presidential race. NPR's Mara Liasson reports on how the Democratic candidates reacted.
The Democratic candidates had been focusing on the chaotic situation in Iraq. Today's news makes that argument more complicated. Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, who co-sponsored the resolution allowing President Bush to go to war, issued a statement reminding voters that he supported the war because it was the right thing to do and that he still feels that way now. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, an outspoken supporter of the war, explained the difference between his position and Howard Dean's.
If Howard Dean had his way, Saddam Hussein would be in power today, not in prison where he belongs.
Dean himself, who achieved his front-runner status in the Democratic race in large part because of his anti-war position, issued a statement congratulating the troops and saying, now that the dictator is captured, we must accelerate the transition from occupation to full Iraqi sovereignty. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Spain's Prime Minister José María Aznar says the capture of Saddam has removed the main obstacle to peace and democracy in Iraq. Aznar was one of President Bush's staunchest allies in the war in Iraq. Jerome Sokolowski has more from Madrid.
The Spanish Prime Minister held a televised address to cheer Saddam's capture. He said it was good news for everyone who wants a world at peace and free of dictators. Aznar said he called the head of the Iraqi Governing Council, Abdelaziz al-Hakim, to congratulate him. Al-Hakim had just met the Spanish Prime Minister on Saturday while visiting Madrid. Aznar also spoke by phone to President Bush. Saddam's arrest is a boon for the Spanish leader, who has struggled to justify his government's support for the war despite overwhelming public disapproval. The leader of the opposition Socialist Party, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, said he hoped the former dictator's arrest would speed what he called the recovery of sovereignty by the Iraqi people. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
And British Prime Minister Tony Blair said Saddam's capture is an opportunity to unify the people of Iraq. This is NPR News.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Reaction is coming in to the news of the capture of Saddam Hussein. Massachusetts Congressman Marty Meehan says the capture will put to rest fears of Iraqis that the former dictator would return. Meehan says it now means that Iraqis can move forward in rebuilding their country.
This is a great day, not just for the United States, for the Iraqi people. Saddam Hussein being out of the picture in that country will certainly greatly enhance the likelihood that a new system of governance can be set up in Iraq for the Iraqi people.
Meehan says it's time for Hussein to face judgment for the crimes he committed against his own people. Retail stores will be able to abandon their decades-old practice of putting price tags on every item under new regulations that will take effect in Massachusetts tomorrow. The regulations, revised by Attorney General Tom Riley in July, allow stores to provide electronic scanners in many cases instead of those individual tags. And another winter storm is upon Massachusetts. The National Weather Service says the Berkshires could get as much as 20 inches of snow by the time the storm moves out tomorrow. Another 8 to 12 inches is expected to the north and west of Boston. In the forecast tonight, snow changing over to all rain east of 128, lows in the 20s. Monday, any leftover snow changing to rain, very windy with a high of 40. Right now, 34 in Boston. It's 9:05.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Goldsmiths 3, designers and craftsmen, for 20 years offering a complete array of original handcrafted fine art jewelry, ready to wear or made to order, open daily through December 24th. And by the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we have the second of two lectures from Nobel laureate and party visiting professor Dr. Murray Gell-Mann. Dr. Gell-Mann is a renowned theoretical physicist and a distinguished fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, a private, nonprofit, multidisciplinary research and education center founded in 1984. He received the Nobel Prize for his work in elementary particle theory. His recent work has focused on complex adaptive systems that learn or evolve by using acquired information. Both last and this week's lectures by Dr. Murray Gell-Mann are entitled Regularities and Randomness in the Past and the Future. Again, he is introduced by Professor David Fromkin, director of the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. Professor Fromkin.
The Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future welcomes you to this second and concluding lecture by Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, Pardee visiting professor at the Pardee Center of Boston University. Dr. Gell-Mann is a Nobel Prize winner in physics, but he is also a Renaissance man with wide-ranging interests and learning. Though most of you heard me introduce him at length a week ago, he literally needs no introduction. He is one of the most famous and celebrated scientists in the world. Dr. Gell-Mann.
Oh, thank you, David, for those kind remarks. Well, it's a pleasure to continue this discussion, regularity and randomness in the past and in the future. Last time I pointed out that the history of the universe is predicted only probabilistically by science, and that the actual history is co-determined by the fundamental laws of physics, which just give probabilities for different alternative histories, and a long, long, long sequence of accidents or chance events, each of which could come out in various ways with probabilities for those different ways. But that is, if we start at the beginning of the universe, the beginning of its expansion 13 billion years ago, if we take into account the fact that there's been 13 billion years of history, then all sorts of things have already happened. And they give a huge amount more information than was available at the beginning. So that gives the opportunity for a great many of those accidents that have already happened to create important regularities themselves, along with, of course, the fundamental laws of physics. And the result is that, as I discussed last time, that all the other sciences other than fundamental physics depend very heavily on accidents, and in particular frozen accidents, which have produced more regularity than a typical accident in some finite region of space and time. I mentioned, for example, the little fluctuation that produced our galaxy which on a cosmic scale is of very little importance, I'm sure, but to anything in this galaxy like us, it's very important. And we could hardly do without the existence of that fluctuation. So when we look at things on a suitable scale and a suitable coarse graining for looking at human history, then we find that there are many, many, many regularities of many different kinds, some of them constituting whole sciences like geology, biology, anthropology, and so on and so forth, which depend for their very existence on accidents that happened at one time or another. But then even within those fields, there are all sorts of other regularities, many of which we discover semi-empirically. And then there are chance events still occurring very often, which look like chance events, even on the scale of human history. We mentioned Annie Oakley just missing the Kaiser with her shot, and there are numerous other such things happening all the time. So history, as we see it, is composed then of grand historical forces, of other subsidiary regularities, some of them perhaps of great importance, and of things that are manifestly accidents and look like accidents. The regularities can be of great importance if one is interested in forecasting the future or in predicting the results of public policy interventions. And we discussed some issues of that kind. I hadn't quite finished talking about one type of regularity that we encounter very frequently in many different places, and that is power laws, in which one variable depends on a power of another, and in particular, power laws of distribution, in which the frequency of occurrence of a certain value for a quantity is equal to a power of that quantity. These power laws of distribution are also very widespread, found in many different sciences. And we discussed them briefly in connection with the populations of metropolitan areas, which obey a power law. We characterize the power laws, you remember, by a number k, which is related to the exponent. So if we approximate a discrete sequence by a continuous sequence, we have the, and little n is the number of cases, then we have dn is c times dx, where x is the variable in question, divided by x to some power, which we call k plus 1. We can solve this equation for n, and then we get an equation for n as a function of x, or x as a function of n. And so we see that the quantity, for example, population of a metropolitan area, goes like a power of the rank plus a constant, where we get the rank, say in the case of metropolitan areas, by looking at the most populous one, the second most populous one, the third most populous one, and so on and so forth, and that gives this rank n. And in the case of metropolitan areas, what we find is that k is roughly 1, which is the so-called zip value of the exponent. So xn goes like 1 over n, roughly, 1 over n plus constant, where the constant is usually not very large. So what we see then is that if we arrange all the cities, say, in the world or in a very large country in order of population, and by city I mean metropolitan area, then the formula goes roughly like 1 over n plus a constant, where n is the rank, and the constant is small, so it goes roughly like 1 over n. And therefore, the population of the 300th city is about a third the population of the 100th city, which you can verify by looking in an almanac. This also leads to this remarkable phenomenon that many people have noticed, many children have noticed, that the first digit is very unevenly distributed the first digit of population is 45 times more likely to be a 1 than to be a 9, where 45 is 9 times 9 plus 1 over 2. We mentioned the discovery 100 years ago by Vilfredo Pareto that over a certain range, income obeys such a power law with a different exponent, not the Zipf exponent, an exponent that can vary from one society to another. And we suggested that in public policy, for example, if somebody is interested in reducing the discrepancy between rich and poor for some reason, then it might be easier not to fight the power law, which seems to be an important regularity and a robust one, but rather to create policies that would change the exponent to a flatter one. Probably easier than getting rid of the power law itself, which seems to be an important regularity. However, we don't understand perfectly where these things come from. And therefore, in every single case of a regularity that we discuss, it would be an enormous help to understand why these regularities exist. In the case of Zipf's law for metropolitan areas, there are arguments, but I think it's not yet completely clear what the causation is. We did point out last time that a power law can be thought of as an exponential of a logarithm, and you can also take the Gaussian of a logarithm, e to the minus constant times log minus a constant quantity squared. And these are the analogs of the familiar distributions, e to the minus x, like the distribution of energies in a gas at a certain temperature, and e to the minus x minus a constant squared, the familiar Gaussian bell-shaped curve. So if we simply substitute the logarithm of x for x, we go from this to a power law and from this to what's called a log normal, e to the minus constant log minus a constant squared. So when noise is multiplicative instead of additive, then you would think that you would go from one of these two laws more or less to one of these two laws. And one of them is a power law, that's this one, and the other one is the log normal. Sometimes it's not so clear from the evidence in a given case whether you're dealing with a power law or a log normal. That may have had something to do with the collapse of long-term capital. It's very important to know whether a rare event way out on the edge of one of these curves is really, really very, very rare or just rare. And the distribution you're using will determine that. And if an event that can cause the collapse of your business is very, very, very rare, you may be all right. But if it's only rare, maybe that's not so good. Now, power laws with the Zipf exponent seem to hold for firm size. If you look carefully, not just at statistics compiled by the government for firms above a certain size, but you look more carefully at essentially all firms, you find that the distribution of number of people in the firm is a Zipf power law. But I want to devote most of today to a very different kind of regularity. It's also called scaling, by the way. So you mustn't mix the two up. They don't have much to do with each other. This is called Gutmann scaling, named after a sociologist, Louis Gutmann, who started this game in the early years of the Second World War. It was very important then to know what the attitudes of Americans were toward Great Britain. Would we make some minor sacrifices in order to help the beleaguered British in the Second World War? After the attack on Pearl Harbor and the declaration of war against us by Hitler and Mussolini, an unbelievably stupid move, I must say, on their part, after that, of course, we were in the war and we were helping Britain, but even then it was still important to know how enthusiastic Americans were about cooperation with Great Britain. And Louis Gutmann had the job of distributing a questionnaire. He's a sociologist, and sociologists like to use questionnaires. So he had a questionnaire with lots of different questions, very different questions, all of which had in common that they seemed to bear in one way or another on the matter of Americans' friendliness toward Great Britain. And he found something quite remarkable when he analyzed these questionnaires. He found that, let's say that the answers were all yes or no, just for simplicity. And let's suppose there were 50 questions. And it was not obvious that the answer to one question would imply the answer to another question, although they had all had something to do with attitudes toward Great Britain. Then there could, in principle, be 2 to the 50th different results for the questionnaire. Yes or no to 50 questions. 2 to the 50th is something like 10 to the 15th, so it's a quadrillion. You could have a quadrillion different responses. But in actual fact, most of the responses were clustered around a very few. 51 of them, in fact. What the regularity that he discovered was that you could arrange the questions in such an order that the responses were close to the following ones. Yes, no, 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 no. Or yes, 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 no, 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 no. Or just no, 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 no. Or yes, 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 and so on. In other words, there was just a single linear sequence of responses, provided you arranged the questions in this particular order, so that you could measure the response simply by the number of yeses followed by the number of noes. So if you just gave the number of yeses, that would describe it. Or if you gave the number of noes, that would describe it. So out of the quadrillion different responses, most of them were concentrated around just 51. Certainly a very striking result. This Gutmann scaling has been used in many, many different fields afterwards, and it always gives remarkable results. And yet, there are huge numbers of well-educated people who don't know much about it. Let's comment on the original questionnaire of Gutmann by giving an example of a situation in which it would be trivial to have Gutmann scaling. Suppose he had asked the following questions of the people to whom he distributed the questionnaire, not questions bearing on attitudes toward Great Britain, but instead, can you jump over a foot and a half hurdle? Can you jump over a 2-foot hurdle? Can you jump over a 2.5-foot hurdle? Can you jump over a 3-foot hurdle? Then obviously those answers would follow the pattern that I just described. The answers would be yes, 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 up to a point, and then no, 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 no. But his questions were not like that. It was not at all obvious that there was an order. Even given the order, it was not obvious that these questions formed the kind of sequence that the hurdle questions form. Not at all. Now, here's another example from linguistics, 1961. The linguist David DeCamp was studying Creole speeches in the Caribbean. You know that there are a number of islands where people speak a Creole at home and an official language in school and in government offices and so on. Sometimes they're not the same. For example, on St. Lucia, the people speak a French-based Creole at home, where most of the words are borrowed from French, although the language doesn't sound a lot like French. You have to learn it. But almost all the vocabulary comes from French. But it's an English island. It's an English language island, and all the public business is conducted in English. In Suriname, the Creole spoken at least on the coastal part of the country, formerly Dutch Guiana, is English-based, going back to the 17th century when the Dutch chose to keep Suriname rather than to trade it for New York. You know that in 1664, the British took New Amsterdam and renamed it New York, but the Dutch could have gotten it back at the Peace of Breda. They chose, however, to keep Suriname instead. It was a place with known wealth and so on. New York was some kind of obscure wilderness. We've all made real estate decisions like that at one time or another. Anyway, in Suriname, the Creole, at least for the one on the coast, is English-based, but the official language of the country is Dutch, and so on. Well, in Jamaica, the official language is English, and the Creole is English-based. That doesn't mean you can understand it if you know English. I'm sure lots of you have heard Jamaicans talking and had a lot of trouble understanding what they were saying. But their speech, their Creole speech, is based, from the point of view of vocabulary, on English. So in those countries where the lexifying language and the official language are the same, you can have the phenomenon of decreolization. What it means is that educated people, or people in cities and so on, have their Creole speech modified by regular standard English habits, speech habits. And what De Camp did was to look at a few cases, two of pronunciation and four of vocabulary, that distinguish Creole from regular English. So here they are. The is pronounced D in the broad Creole. Th is pronounced T. This should be a lower class theta here, but the lowercase theta, but somebody made it an uppercase one. The word child is pikni from the Portuguese, borrowed from the Portuguese pequeno. Didn't is noben from not been. Granny is nana. And eat is nyam, which is a word that's used in many different places around the world for eating. It's usually in baby talk. But in Jamaica, in broad Jamaican Creole, it's the regular word for eating. You use it instead of the word eat. Now, he looked at the speech habits of lots of Jamaicans, and you see that there are 64 possibilities here. The people could say the or de, th or t, child or pickney, didn't or no bang, granny or nana, eat or nyam. So there are 2 to the 6th possibilities, 64 possibilities. Of those 64, he found mostly only 7. And here they are. Pure English situation where you said the, th, child, didn't, granny, eat. That's right here, regular English for all 6. Or people said d, but they didn't say t, pikni, noben, nana, nyam. They just had this one Creole speech habit. Or they had 2, these 2, but always these 2. Or they had 3, but they were always these 3, and so on. Or they had all of them. Now, we can go on to looking at this in anthropology, cultural anthropology. And particularly as Gutman Scaling turns up in cross-cultural surveys. The late George Peter, nicknamed Pete Murdoch, great professor of anthropology at Yale. I'm so sorry that I never met him when I was a Yale undergraduate. He was already on the faculty at that time. He left behind, as one valuable part of his remarkable scientific legacy, the human relations area files in New Haven, which are carefully coded summaries of anthropological data about hundreds of cultures around the world, indexed so as to facilitate cross-cultural comparison, especially now with computers, when access to information is so much easier than it used to be when he started. His professional heirs, those now running the files, and others who collaborated with Murdoch but have since moved elsewhere, have fallen out. The ones in New Haven and the ones elsewhere are angry at each other. And they've fallen out over a number of things, but particularly a mathematical issue of data analysis, of statistics, the so-called problem of Galton. Many of you may run into this problem in your work. It's a very interesting one. The anthropologist E.B. Tyler, T-Y-L-O-R, presented in 1889 in England his classic paper on cross-cultural comparisons, how to study anthropological phenomena across cultures, many, many parts of the world. Sir Francis Galton was present, a great statistician. Many of you have heard of him. He pointed out the distortions that result in this kind of work from failure of cultures to be independent of one another. This can happen through common descent or through cultural diffusion. Today, there are mathematical techniques for dealing with this. There's a matrix that you write down in which you try to estimate in various ways the non-independence, the autocorrelation of this set of cultures, and in that way reduce the danger of distorting your results through these effects. It's especially Douglas R. White, who used to work with Murdoch but is now in California at the University of California, Irvine. It's White and his collaborators who have insisted that attention be paid to this Galton effect. They've also gone further and created cultural samples that seem to have eliminated this autocorrelation to a great extent. In other words, they pick out a sequence of cultures from around the world where there's not much of this relationship, autocorrelation, through either diffusion or common descent. If you're dealing with the Akamba and the Blackfeet, you don't have to worry too much. Not as if you were looking at the Akamba and the Agikuyu. So they have a reduced cross-cultural sample in which they've largely gotten rid of this problem without even using the matrix approach. Then we can look at Gutman scaling applied to a lot of these cross-cultural situations. This and a good deal of work that I'll mention later on is in papers by Robert L. Carneiro, very distinguished anthropologist. Let's look first at a very simple case here. Here are eight characteristics and nine tribes of South American Indians. Social stratification, pottery, fermented beverages, political state, agriculture, stone architecture, smelting of metal ores, and loom weaving. So these are not obviously things that follow one from another. Plus means that the tribe has this trait, and minus means the tribe does not have the trait. But now we arrange the traits in the magical order. And we also, for aesthetic reasons, arrange the tribes in a nice way. What we've done here is to put the largest number of pluses at the bottom, and then the next largest, and so on, up to the top. And then we've listed the tribes in such an order that we have fewer and fewer and fewer of these for the different tribes. What we find now is that there is perfect Gutman scaling, absolutely perfect. The answers are no, yes, 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 or no, no, yes, 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 or no, 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 yes, 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 and so on. Perfect Gutman scaling. For these characteristics which don't sound as if they're particularly related to one another. This diagram is then called a scalogram. Now, this particular scalogram for these particular tribes and traits has some further simplifications besides being perfect. You move one trait at a time. That's one thing. And let's see, what's the other one? Oh, yes, and no two tribes have exactly the same number of plus signs. So they don't have the same, they all have different numbers, and they differ by only one trait as you go up. That's not necessary. That's that's more than perfect scaling. That's just a special circumstance which we can get rid of, and we will get rid of it in future cases. Now, one theory of how this works is that it represents a time sequence, an evolutionary pattern, a kind of main sequence, like the main sequence for the evolution of stars, something of that kind, in which you have a regular succession of stages, and we have just caught these different tribes at different stages. The movement can go at various rates, and we have caught these peoples at different stages in a process, in a steady process of change. That would account for the Gutmann scaling. It doesn't mean that you understand why you have this succession, but if you assume that there is a temporal succession, you would see that you have to have this scaling as a result. Now, we have to realize that this idea of evolutionary sequences is a very old one. In the 19th century, after the great success of biological evolution, a lot of people tried to think of many different things, including social phenomena, in terms of evolution. And many anthropologists presented very simple schemes for successive stages. Franz Boas, a very, very distinguished anthropologist, taught that every culture is unique, and of course, that's true to a great extent. But therefore, we mustn't look for regularities. We mustn't look for laws. Can't have them in anthropology. This sort of thing. Well, one argument, the scientific argument that they made was, how do you know these are temporal sequences? Maybe they're not. Well, that's easily answered. You look and see. You look at cases where you know the temporal sequence and see if it agrees with the Gutmann scaling sequence. So Carneiro has done that. This was his first attempt. He looked at Anglo-Saxon England over several centuries. And he applied to it this scalogram. This is a big scalogram, 50 cultural traits, yes or no, in 100 societies. Here are the 100 societies, and here are the 50 cultural traits. Special religious practitioners, trade between communities, formal political leadership, social segments above the family, peacekeeping machinery, communities of 100 or more, significant social status differences, craft specialization, domesticated food sources, judicial process, craft production for exchange, full-time political leader, death penalty decreed, full-time retainers for the political leader, super-provincial organization, so on and so on. Here are temples. Here is the corvée. You know what that is, a compulsory labor service on the part of lower-class people. Here's taxation in kind, military conscription, towns of 2,000 or more, royal court, and so on and so forth. Somewhere in here is a calendar. Calendar comes after the death penalty. So again, it's not at all obvious that these should form a sequence. But then what he did was to compare this kind of thing with evidence. He took 33 selected traits from that list that we just saw, and made a scalogram, and then he superposed on the scalogram how it agreed with the temporal sequence, the sequence in time, for Anglo-Saxon England. And these S's mean insufficient information, and the reason for that is that all these things were settled by the Angles and Saxons before they came to England. So it's not relevant to scientific test. But from here on, that wasn't true anymore. And if you look at these, you see check marks, X's, and an occasional S. There's an S with a little curlicue on it, S without a curlicue. Those refer to insufficient information, the S's. But the checks mean agreement, and the X's mean disagreement. In other words, if you have a check mark, everything is proceeding in the right order for Gutmann scaling. When you have an X, then things have gotten transposed. something is occurring after something else when it should occur before, vice versa. Well, there aren't such a lot of X's. There are some, but there's not a lot. So it's working moderately well. There is a reasonable, very reasonable correlation between the Gutmann scaling and the temporal sequence for Anglo-Saxon England. But you can look and see much more. The X's are all near the diagonal. Very few of them down here. In fact, none of them out here. They begin around here, and they're rare. And then most of the X's are right near the diagonal. That means that the cases where things are occurring in the wrong order are cases where they're very close to each other. Two neighboring traits being interchanged, for example, in order. Or two traits that are spaced two apart getting exchanged, that kind of thing. Whereas if they're spaced 5 or 10 apart, they are not exchanged. That means the phenomenon is genuine. We have Gutmann scaling, we have a temporal sequence, and they agree, but they agree with some slop. Well, that's not unexpected in human affairs. And it's still very remarkable that the extent to which they do agree. Now, he now notices the connection with complexity. You remember, we talked about effective complexity, which I believe to be the kind of complexity we talk about in ordinary conversation and in most scientific discourse, and that it depends on picking out certain things as important and then looking at how long it takes to describe the regularities and how long it takes to and not how long it takes to describe the random or incidental features, where the random or incidental features refer to things that were judged unimportant. Well, in social science, you always have a list of things that you consider important. And that's what the anthropologists do. They're talking about cultural traits. They then define social complexity or cultural complexity, and it has to do with how long it takes at a minimum to describe the complications of that society in culture. So when there are a lot of special roles for people, you know, people who are goldsmiths and people who make pottery and people who are policemen and people who are advisors to the king and so on and so on, you have a lot of social complexity. If you have a band doing hunting and gathering, where if there's any pottery making, it's done by all the families, and if there's catching of game, it's done by all the men, and so on and so forth. In that society, it just doesn't take very long to describe the social complications, and it is not a complex society. It's a simple one. So they use this notion of social complexity, which agrees very well with my definition of effective complexity as applied to social science. And they notice that these are all in an order of increasing cultural complexity. And so Carneiro says, yes, but that's been studied. Let's look at the various famous anthropologists who have given their impression of a scale of rising cultural complexity, and let's see where they put these different societies. So he did that, and he compared this scalogram result with the results of those famous anthropologists. Krober, K-R-O-E-B-E-R, this is a very great anthropologist at the University of California, Berkeley, who studied mostly Indian tribes in California and studied their languages particularly and classified them. He's also well known because of his association with Ishi, the last Yahi, and the book written about him by Krober and also by Mrs. Krober, Theodora Krober. He personally estimated levels of cultural intensity, and he ranked all these societies according to that guess of his as to the order in which their cultural complexity appeared. But mainly, we have to realize that there are numerous details that are not captured in this analysis, and that give rise to cultural individuality. And appreciate, just as we said last time, appreciating regularities does not mean that we totally ignore the features that are unconstrained by those regularities. Regularities do not exclude individuality. They are the pattern is a pattern composed of a delicate interplay of order and randomness, or of regularity and individuality. There are also occasional failures of the whole scheme, and they're very interesting too. They don't invalidate this work because they occur only here and there. But when they do occur, they're very interesting. For instance, certain traits are just skipped in certain cultures. They ought to come in at a certain point in the sequence, but they don't appear, and then they never appear. Never appear until much later when you have globalization or something. For instance, for some very advanced Polynesian societies, you don't have pottery and you don't have loom weaving, which they ought to have for their level of sophistication in every other respect. But perhaps they didn't have the right clays and the right fibers. Or there may have been some other reason why, some other environmental reason why these things were skipped in that particular place. So there are a number of such environmental effects that also contribute to individuality by violating the rules. But the violations are not common. They occur here and there. Now, another very important question that we have to ask is about devolution, regression. There's no particular reason for this kind of accumulation to occur all the time. Suppose a society migrates and passes through an environment in which many of their sophisticated traits are no use. For example, going from a temperate climate to near the North Pole, crossing the Bering Strait, something of that kind. Couldn't a lot of traits be lost in the course of such a migration? Because they would have no meaning, no relevance in the environment through which the people passed. Then, in getting to a temperate climate at the other end of the trip, after maybe hundreds of years or more, they may want to reacquire these traits. They may be useful to reacquire them. Well, does that happen? It does seem to happen from time to time, but does it disturb the scalogram? Well, if you're going to keep the scalogram the same, we would have to have the traits peeling off the end in reverse order and then growing in correct order when they reach the place where those traits have meaning again. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that would be a very interesting thing to look at. If not, then migration through such regions would have to be considered a violation of the whole scheme. Doesn't happen that often, so it doesn't invalidate the analysis. But it would be interesting to see which is true. So what's happening then is something that we should be familiar with from what we discussed last time, that we have regularities that roll on and on and on and on, despite the fact that underneath all sorts of crucial details are changing. You remember this, the distance you could go in a day in France, despite the fact that we were going from horses to carriages to railroad trains to automobiles to airplanes to jet planes and so on. Still, with all that going on underneath, there was a very smooth curve, in fact, almost exact exponential for the distance as a function of time over two centuries. So that was just, that regularity was rolling on while underneath there were all these immensely impressive differences being generated as you went from one era to another. So that must also be true of these regularities. They roll on while other important details vary widely. And that certainly gives a lot of room for individuality. Now, does an evolutionary time sequence really explain or agree with all of the Gutmann scaling results? Well, not so clearly. For example, that original questionnaire that Gutman handed out about attitudes toward Great Britain and the United States, that doesn't seem to have much to do with complexification of societies. And the linguistic example that we gave, David DeCamp's study of decreolization in Jamaica, well, that is, in a sense, a time sequence, because an individual Jamaican can move over time from one social class to another, can move from being rural to urban, from being uneducated to being more educated, and so on and so on, and in the course of that can move in the decreolization continuum from a broad Creole to a Creole that's more and more affected by English, and finally to speaking standard English instead of the Creole. So time can be involved there, but it's not exactly the same time. You're not talking about the complexification of the whole society. The thing that's most remarkable about all this is that for many, many, many decades, the high muckamucks of anthropology forbade all this kind of thing. You weren't allowed to do research on it. You weren't allowed to think about it. You weren't allowed to believe it. It was forbidden. And that's extraordinary. And we've seen it in other sciences. In linguistics, you're not allowed to think about large groupings bigger than the families that the historical linguists like to deal with that are 7,000 years old or so, like Indo-European, Uralic, Austronesian, and so on. If you study higher groupings that consist of such families, several such families, you're an outcast. You're a pariah of some sort. And the same was true here if you studied evolutionary sequences. It's not true anymore, at least not for everybody. But for a long time, it was true. And that is something that's much more remarkable than these regularities themselves, this effective prohibition of studying them and thinking about them by brilliant people. These anthropologists were not dumb people at all. They were extremely bright, but their ideological biases overcame their scientific instincts, and they simply wouldn't look. There are a number of other questions, similar questions, that we might ask about. The material we've talked about today is probably not of immediate utility in forecasting the longer-range human future. The reason being that a lot of these changes of interest to anthropologists have already happened, and now most of the changes have to do with the encroachment by a global civilization rather than the, so to speak, natural local developments that would be summarized by the regularities we talked about. And in the future, it will be true even more. But who says that these future developments involving acculturation, migration, and so on, that they don't have some laws associated with them, too, some important regularities? And discovering those could be of great interest to the study of the long-range future. One thing I would particularly recommend, and in fact some of us at SFI might even try to initiate such a thing, is to study migration itself. What happens when a group of people migrate to a place where there is a group of very different people? Are there general rules about what happens in such a case? The hostilities that develop, the patterns of cooperation that develop, the acculturation by one group taking a lot of cultural features from the other one. For language, which we're particularly interested in, when does it happen that the language is the language of the natives and it is the language of the migrants that's largely lost? And when does it happen that the migrants impose their language? Maybe because they're military conquerors, but maybe for some other reason. And conquest by no means assured, by the way, that it's the migrants who will impose their language, even if they are the conquerors. It often happens that it occasionally happens that the conquered people's language is the one that's preserved, albeit with a lot of borrowings from the other one. That's what happened in the Norman conquest of England. We still speak English. We've got a huge number of French words, in English, but it's still English. So questions of that kind, I think, may turn up regularities that are just as exciting as the ones that we've been discussing, and perhaps somewhat more relevant to the prediction of the human future. But what about work that's already been done? Are there things that have already been carried out that have been unnecessarily disparaged? Well, there's Arnold Toynbee's study of history, for example, in which he looks at the rise and fall of some 21 civilizations, great civilizations, and tries to find laws in the rise and fall of these civilizations. Now, as a first attempt, we shouldn't expect his work to be magnificent, flawless, perfect, and so on. We should give him some leeway in doing this, in such a grandiose project. Even if he did some of it right, we should think it's pretty important and try to improve on it. But that's not really what's happened. Hardly anyone has taken it up at all. Now, of course, he did some things to attract derision. For example, he gave some indications here and there that he regarded the whole of human history as leading up to the founding of the Anglican Church. Not all of us would agree with that. But he didn't actually say that. He just sort of implied it here and there. So it's easy to make fun of some things about him. But why isn't there a lot of work on trying to bring his ideas up to date, correct them, fix them up, do something with them? Apparently not. Today, there are books on the rise and fall of great powers. Paul Kennedy has one. There are a couple of others. Since some people seem to be making us into a great power, we should think about that a little bit. And it may be worthwhile to look into laws for that as well. But there are also attempts nowadays to create a slightly mathematical theory of history. There's a book just out by Peter Turchin of that kind. And it may be that that kind of work has some promise for the future, and also some relevance for the forecasting of the long-range future and for forecasting the results of public policy interventions. Well, perhaps the search for regularities in human history is becoming a trifle more respectable than it used to be, and that could well portend some significant improvement in our ability to discuss the human future. Thank you.
You've been listening to Nobel laureate and Pardee Visiting Professor Dr. Murray Gell-Mann in the second of two lectures on Regularities and Randomness in the Past and the Future. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes its shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Matt Largy with help from Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us. This is WBUR. Coming up ahead at 10 o'clock, it's the latest on yesterday's capture of Saddam Hussein by the BBC, followed by My Word at 10:30. Iraqis rejoice at the news of yesterday's capture of Saddam Hussein. To read more about the story and reaction, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. This is WBUR. It's 9:58.
I'm Robin Young. Around the holidays, we're reminded that it's better to give than to receive. But at WBUR, we're letting you do both.